Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament House.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Today in the headlines, residents are returning to parts of Victoria ravaged in a week-long bushfires as conditions ease across the state thanks to more favourable weather conditions. New board members have been appointed for the Adelaide Festival after this year's event was cancelled. And an inquiry into proposed hate speech laws has heard that the quoting of religious texts would be very specific and narrow exemption to the legislation. That and more coming up in the news. Residents are returning to parts of Victoria ravaged in week-long bushfires as conditions ease across the state thanks to more favourable weather conditions. But several major fires continue to burn out of control, including the massive Longwood blaze, which has destroyed 90 homes and burned 144,000 hectares. The fires have razed at least 500 buildings, including more than 200 homes, damaged 1,000 farms and been linked to the death of a farmer, Maxwell Hobson, whose body was found on Sunday in a fire ground in the state's northeast. Authorities are examining the possibility that fire near the town of Alexandra ignited from a trailer causing sparks on the Hume Freeway, though arson has not been ruled out either. New board members have been appointed for the Adelaide Festival after this year's event was cancelled. South Australia's Arts Minister, Andrea Michaels, has announced the names of the new board members, Judy Potter, Rob Bookman, Jane Doyle and John Irving. The festival was cancelled after almost 200 speakers and its director withdrew from the festival in protest over the removal of a Palestinian-Australian writer, Dr. Randa Abdel Fattah. The state's premier, Peter Malinauskas, says he stands by his support for that decision.
Criticise me to be too strong. Criticise me not being strong enough. I've got to be consistent. On all these things, I do my best to examine my conscience and offer a view that I believe is consistent with the interests of compassion and advancing the cause of people treating each other with decency and humanity, regardless of their background. It's genuinely what I try to do.
An inquiry into proposed hate speech laws has heard that the quoting of religious texts would be a very specific and narrow exemption to the legislation. In their current form, new offences for aggravated hate speech and serious vilification will not apply to quoting or referencing religious texts for the purpose of religious teaching or discussion. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the government must be careful not to infringe on religious freedoms and have consulted with religious leaders when drafting the laws.
I encourage you to read the Old Testament and see what's there, and see if you outlaw that, what would occur. So we need to be careful. We consulted with faith groups, not just with the Jewish community. We want to make sure there's the broadest possible support, but we also want to make sure that there isn't unintended consequences of the legislation as well.
The race is on to choose Australia's next ambassador to the United States after Kevin Rudd's resignation. The former Prime Minister will finish in the role at the end of March, stepping down from the post nearly a year ahead of schedule, with plans to return as President and Chief Executive of the Asia Society Policy Analysis Centre. Former Labor figures Joel Fitzgibbon and Stephen Conroy are believed to be in the running for the posting. Responding to speculations that he is also up for consideration, Trade Minister Don Farrell has told reporters he's content to remain where he is.
I'm very happy as Australia's trade minister. It's a really important job right now. We, as I said before, we're in an age of uncertainty. We've been able to achieve record trade over the last 12 months, but I think we can do even more, and I'd like to be part of that process.
A woman who slammed a cream crepe into the face of a chief minister has been given a 12-month suspended jail sentence for aggravated assault. Susan Lee Milgate has been found guilty in December after being filmed hitting Miss Files with a pastry at Darwin's Nightcliffe Markets in September 2023. Judge Julie Franz has ruled the crepe was an offensive weapon that had caused injury to the then Northern Territory leader, Natasha Files, who was left with bruising around her eye. And now to sport. In football news, Adelaide United has denied allegations by former player Josh Cavallo that he received homophobic treatment at the A-League Men's Football Club. The 26-year-old left the club in May to move to the United Kingdom after limited game time in his two final seasons, and he currently plays for lower-tier Stamford. Adelaide United has released a statement saying it categorically rejects Mr. Cavallo's claims that he was benched because he was gay. The club says all on-field decisions relating to team selection are made solely on footballing grounds, and that Adelaide United has always been committed to fostering an inclusive environment for players, staff, and supporters. And now for today in the weather, Perth is sunny at 18, Darwin is seeing some clouds at 29, Brisbane is cloudy at 27, Sydney is seeing possible rain at 24, Canberra is some rain, possible storms at 23, Melbourne is overcast at 18, Hobart is seeing possible showers at 14, and Adelaide is sunny at 22. And that's the latest in the news, sport and weather. You're listening to NITV Radio. Cooler conditions are helping fire crews in Victoria contain the raging bushfires, which have devastated regional communities around the state for the past 6 days. But with many blazes still out of control, those communities now face an overwhelming recovery and uncertain future, as NITV Radio reports. Warwick O'Donnell thought he was prepared for the approaching inferno, but was still caught by surprise.
I went in my room to pack a bag, packed my bag, and, yeah, again, looked out the window to see how much time I had, and the fire was there. It was here. It was at the house. It was at the front on the road. And I pretty much had to jump out the window to get to the car before the fire hit the car.
As he fled, his car was engulfed on the road by a massive fireball, which lasted for several hundred metres.
It just turned into like a cocoon. It was just, yeah, orange, yellow, red, and blinding, completely blinding. Couldn't see a thing. I was almost about to pull over because I didn't want to drive into someone else. I didn't know what was going to be in front of me. And luckily, it just started to clear. And, yeah, it just started to clear.
His home at Longwood East withstood the fire, but he lost his shed, workshop and all his tools. Shaken by his near-death experience, he says he should have left his property earlier. It's advice that Premier Jacinta Allen continues to give residents, even as the fire threat begins to slowly ease.
Fire continues today in many parts of the state. It's another difficult day for our emergency services. It's another difficult day for those communities that are continuing to be under fire threat. It's a reminder that we do need to continue to follow the advice of our emergency services. If you are told to leave, do so.
Cooler temperatures and lighter winds are helping firefighters contain the blazes on the sixth day of Victoria's bushfire emergency. But crews are still fighting 12 major bushfires, with dozens more active, including two under emergency warnings in the border region near Walwa and the Otways region in the southwest. Advice for the most damaging of the bushfires at Longwood in central Victoria has now been downgraded to watch and act, while blazes at Nuttamuck and Mount Mercer have been contained. As authorities applaud the incredible work of Victoria's Country Fire Authority and volunteers, Emergency Management Commissioner Tim Weebush says its resources are being boosted from interstate.
That's been bolstered by 380 interstate resources, and they've come from almost all parts of Australia now. We've got Queensland, New South Wales, ACT, South Australia that are here helping our Victorian emergency services as well.
But the damage so far has been extensive and fatal. A person was found dead about 100 metres from a vehicle near the town of Gober within the Longwood fire footprint on Sunday. More than 350 structures have been destroyed across the state, including at least 80 homes and 3 businesses. And there is damage to infrastructure, rail lines, vineyards and cropland, while thousands of residents remain without power. More than 400,000 hectares of land has been razed and an estimated 15,000 head of livestock has been lost. Like hundreds of farmers, Terrapta resident Vicky Gilbert was forced to abandon her animals when she evacuated her property near Longwood.
To leave was very, very hard because I didn't want to leave my horses and my beautiful cattle. My cattle are my world and have been for the last 20 years. So that was a pretty heartbreaking decision to make, but I did leave. And, yeah, it's been like a roller coaster of emotions and all of that type of thing, just wondering if they're okay.
Meanwhile, there are fears the impact on native wildlife could be serious. Shelley Stafford from the Naba View Wildlife Shelter, south of Longwood, says she's been treating animals for burns and smoke inhalation.
Today we got a falcon in, a ringtail possum. I've gone for a drive through their areas. And been checking a lot of birds, deceased, a wombat deceased, burnt. The animals will come out over the next couple of weeks and it'll get worse.
The federal and Victorian governments announced a $19.5 million assistance package, including one-off relief payments, accommodation support and animal fodder for farmers. In addition, the state government is funding expanded mental health support, and payments of up to $52,000 will be available from Friday to help people who have lost their homes. Victorian Minister for Emergency Services, Vicky Ward.
So if you haven't got the money that you need to start to re-establish yourself, if you don't have building or contents insurance, if you cannot return home because of the damage that is there or the destruction, if you cannot get to your home for more than 7 days, you may well be eligible for this payment.
Regional communities say impact of a disaster of this scale can last many years, and recovery involves not just rebuilding, but preparation for future natural disasters, reviving the local economy, and providing emotional and mental health support for the entire community. Natalie Eagleton is the CEO of non-for-profit Foundation for Rural Regional Renewal.
What we often hear after big disasters like this is that there's a recovery from the recovery. So just getting through this early phase, which will probably take, you know, in terms of those that have lost huge amounts of property, livestock, infrastructure, homes, you know, that part actually takes a really long time in itself. But recovering from that then is another phase, just really being able to regroup, think about what next, you know, get to grips with what happened can really often mean a re-imagining of community and place when something this disruptive happens.
For now, authorities remain focused on confronting fire threats because Country Fire Authority Chief Officer Jason Heffernan says more hot weather is on the way.
It's likely to be another heating event towards the end of January. To the extent, that's yet to be determined, but I guess the indication there is, you know, there's been a lot of fire in the landscape. Much work will be done between now and then to contain these fires.
That story by Edwina Guinan for SBS News, produced by Nari Pakai for NITV Radio. A landmark NITV film is set to premiere Monday, 19th of January at 8:30 p.m. The Kalaino Heart. The film explores a First Nations family whose courage, creativity, and resilience propelled them from early 1900s racism and oppression to the global circus stardom at the cost of hiding their Indigenous identity. NITV Radio's Kerry Lee Berry has a conversation with the director, Pauline Clagg. Have a listen to this.
Inagay, everyone. Aja waja yagul. Naya Pauline Clagg. So I'm a Yagul woman from the north coast of New South Wales, Pauline Clegg, and I'm the director of The Kalaino Heart.
I've seen the documentary film. It's absolutely magnificent. Pauline, well done. Where do we start, sis? How do we start
with
the fact that you've got a personal connection to this story? Did you want to explain that for us first up, hey?
When I was seven, I was in Lismore Hospital for a year, and my mum told me the connection of a family storyline that just sort of kind of captivated me because I only saw my parents once a week. They drove up and visited me once a week, and I would constantly ask her about this family, the Sullivans, who then became the Kalainos. And they just intrigued me. At the same time, my dad gave me a book called The Hobbit, which I then started reading and created this magical world in my head of the Kalainos living in this Middle Earth, and Mordor was the British Empire and Australia policies. And I just wanted to tell this story in some shape or form. I always thought I'd be the producer. I started collating newspaper articles when I was 12, and then, you know, started digitizing and creating a database when I was in my early 20s again. And then about 15 years ago, I tried to, you know, get the story up and running, and I couldn't. And I think it was partly because there were options held elsewhere in Australia at the time to some of the footage. And I just knew it needed, you know, something or someone else. And then I heard that Rhoda Roberts was developing a story, either in theatre and in film. And so I just like thought, oh, well, at least Rhodes has got it, you know. And then I got a call from Wild Bear asking, would I be interested in telling the story? And I said, I would, as long as family were a part of it. Because for me, even though there is a book and it is about Con and his amazing work, the whole family as a whole were impressive. And I wanted to make sure that when you tell stories that are our stories to tell, it's not just about the one that shines through, it's about the collective, you know? And mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that I found the family. You know, I knew that somewhere in the world the family line would have had someone that was being told stories like I was, orally, because if they had that Indigenous way of telling, there had to be someone in the family that was holding some of those stories. And I was lucky that, you know, 4 years ago we found Molly.
And Molly, you just mentioned there, is featured throughout the film. What was it like when you first met Molly?
I just felt like I had a kindred spirit. Like, it was weird. Like, she had been given all these stories from her mum, who was one of the Kalaino sisters. And on top of it, she'd spent time in Florida with her Auntie Joyce and Auntie Winnie and Uncle Con. And, you know, like, so, and I don't know, like, even though she hadn't been brought up, you know, she was very American in so many ways, but very Indigenous in so many other ways, even though in their mind, they hadn't been brought up that way. The family had made sure that there were traits in their lives that held them in that very communal way of sharing and caring, you know?
And that really shines through in the documentary. And when I was watching it, you with Molly there in her house over in the United States of America, you looked right at home, sis. Hey, true God.
Yeah. And I think, and, you know, and at the same time finding Deb here in Australia and finding her, you know, I think in one way, sis, it's that we've got to start having these conversations about how do we talk about those other generations that we don't, we talk heavily in this country about the stolen generation. We don't really talk about the hidden generation. We don't talk about the new generation that are DNAing and finding their connections. And how do we talk about how do they come home and hear the stories that need to be told about our mob and also about their own family? And how do we connect them again to those ways of teaching and linking with each other? And I think that was something that I was, you know, hopefully really proud that we've done with this film, is not just tell an amazingly epic story about a family who become some of the biggest names in the world in the circus fraternity, but also how do we talk about identity in this country in a way that heals us as well and starts to not point fingers but understand all of the layers and complexities that were happening in that 1900s period to make our people want to see a better future for their children and hide.
Let's talk about the film and what it's all about, sis. Can you give us a rundown, a synopsis of what people can be watching?
So it's a story about an Aboriginal family who, instead of becoming involved in the sort of policies of the Aboriginal Protection Act in the 1900s, evade it by becoming a circus act and then escaping Australia on the crunch of the stolen generation era, because Julia never wanted to separate her 10 children. And so they escaped overseas and became a part of the greatest show on earth, the Barnum Ringling Circus, and then led exceptional lives that their children and next generation are now reconnecting back with Australia now that they know who they are, because they hid their identity for generations because of the issues of what was happening in the racist Australia in that period of time.
And what you described there, when they did leave Australia, 10 children, mum and dad, they went to London and then found themselves over in the United States in Brooklyn, Pauline.
Mm, yeah. And sort of kind of, you know, in a playground of the, you know, 1920s, the roaring 20s, when, you know, in the heyday of, you know, Harlem and Broadway and sort of living large in a way with immense skills in entertainment by that point. And the world was their oyster and they performed with some of the best and were some of the best.
How would you describe one of the fellas featured, one of the main characters, Con Sullivan or Con Colino? Tell us about what that fella was like, hey?
They were all a little bit of a, you know, the black fella in them, they were jokesters, they were tricksters. But he was the wizard on the wire. He was a centre ring act for years in the circus. Is a Hall of Famer. One of him and his little sister, Winnie, or older sister, I should say, but she's called Little Winnie because his wife was also known as Winnie. is also Winnie. Very confusing in their family. They've got a lot of names that are the same. but he was the first tight wire act to do the forward somersault on the wire, and the only one for probably about 30 years. The forward somersault on the tight wire is one of the hardest tricks to do because you can't see the wire as you land. So it's an instinctive thing that he did. And not a lot of people could do that act for a long period of time. Still to this day, there's only a few that have done it. And he did it nearly every day for, 40 years of his life.
And also throughout the documentary, there's a real sense that family really had to hide their Aboriginal identity from the world as performers, and they'd perform under other identities, cultural identities from around the world.
In the end, sort of kind of created the persona around the Spanish sort of kind of act in a way. And I suppose in a way that circus period, there was still the exotic, the native savage sort of kind of show and tell part. And so wanting to be above that, they were the highest paid, especially Con, he was one of the highest paid circus acts in the world. And so, at the same time, there were still those exotic sideshows going on for, Aboriginal savages and the, so he wanted to be above that and to perform to his highest ability. And so, they sadly hid their identity for a long period of time, and the next generation didn't know that they were what their connection was. They knew that they were connected to Australia, and that was about it. So when they started to learn the history, they were amazed. And so at the age of, in her 80s, Molly coming back to Australia to finally learn what that connection meant, and going on the journey with this film to understand some of that history, has been a remarkable, not just for her, but for the rest of the family, to learn some of that story as we were going along and filming with them and being a part of helping them to see what that story is and how, it can sometimes be damaging but also healing to hear some of the things that their family had to go through to get to where they are today.
One thing that really impressed me in the documentary was the use of the archival footage, the still photos and the moving images. And I understand this was available because Con, back in the day, in the early 1900s, owned a camera, sis.
Yeah, wow. So could almost call him now our first documentarian, because in the early 1920s, when they left Australia, he brought a camera and started documenting their family and the life that they led around the world. I mean, they were a part of, and the joy of seeing, we're so used to seeing footage in Australia of that period of the 1900s to the 1930s that is slightly propaganda-ish, of Aboriginal Australia, sort of people in mission status and being marched into spaces and, and then you see this archival footage that the family had and it's them having joy and, it's stuff that we're so not used to in terms of our own archives here in Australia. And so being able to show joy in that period and just our, family swimming and families dancing and was really special to sort of see, they look like us, they sound like us, but they're doing all this stuff in different parts of the world and living in a way that, is not oppressive, and in a way showing, being able to show that our community has such resilience in joy and life and love at the same time as, you know, some hard truths that are happening around us, you know?
True, sis. And like you said, you know, back in the early 1900s, it wasn't us mob holding the cameras. It was non-Indigenous folk. Yeah. So for me, what I was so fascinated and impressed by, that Con Sullivan owned his own camera. And for me, it was a real joy to be able to witness an Aboriginal person from that time taking photographs. I've never seen that before, sis, in my life.
It's one of the reasons why, for me, I've always wanted to tell this story. I knew that footage was there. And so, it's like, for me, I'm like, one of these days, that's the footage. It's the ungettable get for me. As I said, I always thought I would produce it, but being able to direct a story like this, I'm sort of kind of glad that I was obsessively looking for archives all the time. I knew that this family was taking photos and creating footage of eras that we have never seen in that light, of Aboriginal people doing that sort of kind of, and dressing that way and moving that way. What was fun to do with this documentary was, because all the films were silent, was to do some Foley and give sound back to that and make them alive again and hear laughter in that, was really special. You know, it made, I remember Molly and the family seeing it for the first time, them all crying because they, you know, like their family were alive again in front of them, you know, and it was, one of my proudest moments of showing them the film when they realized that there was sound now attached to their mum's dancing or their, you know, their auntie's dancing.
And you just mentioned there about the fashion this amazing family wore, that was ever so impressive throughout the documentary. I thought their fashion was just next level. So beautiful, the way they would dress.
Yeah, and to think of it, little Winnie, one of the performers, she was making all of their dresses and stuff. So they obviously were a kind of, you know, we say, I think we've had this conversation in the past, but for a mob to survive this country for, you know, in time immemorial, you know, 100,000 years or whatever, we'd have to be quite exceptional. So, like, when you give, you know, when you give them the opportunity to be the best of the best, you know, we rise to the challenge, you know? And I think that was one thing that I loved, you know, like, they were rising to the challenge of, you know, living in a period when they were creating the look, their look, they were a part of creating, you know, circus acts that had never been seen before. You know, they were wowing the audience while they were making sure that they were loving and supporting each other around the world. You know, it's quite an exceptional family that, it's amazing that we don't, you know, we know this ourselves, you know, the Pastor Dougs of the world, the, you know, there is, David Unipens, there is so many of our stories of exceptional mob that still haven't been told. And I was lucky that I had at least the footage and the photos to be able to help to tell this story, because that's often the reason why we don't tell these stories, is because we don't have that archives to be able to tell it the way that we need to tell it, you know?
Yeah, true. Hey, sis, do you have any highlights in working on this documentary for so many years, sis?
Oh, too many. I mean, I don't know if it's a highlight, but it was funny driving around, you know, I don't know if it was funny, but we were shooting around the time when a week before the elections for Trump last year. It was weird to be in that space at that time. I loved having Halloween in America with the family. I thought it was so weird and wonderful and such an American thing to do for an Australian family in so many ways, because like when you hang with them that much, you start to see how similar they are to you. So you don't, you know, as I said, you in the film, you know, you hear their American accent, but the way that they look after each other and laugh with each other is such a blackfella way of communicating that you sort of kind of had to, you had to keep catching yourself and going, oh, that's right. You know, they still have that Americanism in them. But, yeah, I think my, our, you know, I'm so proud that, you know, being able to take Deb and Molly back on the country and to do a proper cleansing with the women in Narrabri was just, you know, so special. And, yeah, there's so many. There's just so many things. You know, I wish we would have had more time. But as I said to everyone else and the family included, that this is just the start of the story, you know, and it's up to them to now tell more, you know, we're the little pebble that got put in the pond and has started the ripple, and it's now up to them to tell more of the stories, because they're an amazing family that need to, like many of our families, we still need to tell these stories that and unearth them as much as we can.
And just my final question to you today, Sis Pauline, what did your family, the mob here, think of this sudden story as it folded and the more you discovered and researched and more of the story came out? Were they quite fascinated? Were they shocked? Were they not shocked? How were they feeling?
Mum knew a lot of the story. So, like, that's why for me, I was so glad that before she passed, I was able to say that we were going ahead with it. You know, she was glad that we were finally telling this story. I think people in so many ways here in Australia were like, we would know about them if they were that famous.
Yeah, and true, eh? That's exactly how I felt, sis. Yeah.
That's the bit that just I kept coming up against. Like, people were like, really? I don't know whether or not, are you talking porkies? Like, it was, they were, you know, it was that, they were almost like the Forrest Gump. They, in so many ways, in a significant part of history from the 1920s to the 1950s, that family were a part of some of those moments, you know, and we couldn't put all of the moments in. You know, they, you know, one of them, you know, had made Princess Margaret laugh so much, and Princess Elizabeth, back when they were princesses, when Princess Elizabeth wasn't a queen yet, but it made them laugh so much that they fell off their chairs at the Royal Gala when they performed. You know, like, we couldn't put that story in because we were like, God, you know, like,
hey, look out.
It's that thing of like they were Forrest Gumping in the middle of these big moments of history, and they were blackfellas, you know, like, and we were like, how do we not know? Like, I just don't understand why we don't know these stories. Mm. Why don't we know about our legends here in Australia? Mm. That, you know, and part of it is because we have, you know, we just have a silence when it comes to supporting the good things about Aboriginal Australia, as well as, you know, we're so used to hearing just the negative stories. And I think it's time for us to tell more than just the negative, you know, and to show that resilience and that love for family that we have, you know.
Thanks so much for joining us on NITV Radio today, Pauline Clegg. It's been an absolute pleasure. Well done to you and the team. Look forward to seeing how this documentary will travel around the world, which I have no doubt it will, sis. Well done.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, sis.